one thing that's certainly we're thinking about longer term is the fusion of the real world and the metaverse. So, you know, let's say we were having this conversation in avatars, which is probably not that far off potentially. You know, we could be in a scenario where you could be wearing your fractional, you know, Rolex watch on your wrist that you're an owner, right? Exactly. And you know, how cool would that be? You know, it's that social capital element. You're seeing people already putting NFTs on their Twitter accounts, and there's an element of exclusivity and, you know, I guess almost boasting around some of these things. But you know, as we move more into the metaverse and the digital realm, having the ability to, let's say, have a digital replica of something you actually own and it's verified, I think that could be really powerful. And that's something we could do with this fractional ownership model.
Welcome. Welcome to YFAML.com, the podcast, a place for young entrepreneurs get inspired by people like you who don't just talk about the dreams and aspirations, but actually do and take action. So today we have Richard Draper here. He's the co-founder at Koya, an alternative investment platform. You know, so instead of investing in stocks, you invest in goods, you know, such as watches, wine, champagne. Richard will explain better what I'm doing now in a second, but yeah. And so, yeah, why don't you just go ahead and tell us a bit about your background, what you've done so far? Yeah.
Absolutely. So hi, everyone. Great to be on the podcast. Thanks for inviting me on, Roger. So my name is Richard. And as already mentioned, I'm one of the co-founders of Koya. And Koya is a fractional investment platform that opens up access to alternative assets, such as fine wine, watches, luxury assets, even NFTs. We can fractionalize anything with our technology. And the idea is to essentially take alternative assets mainstream. In terms of my background, I spent a number of years working in financial services. So I worked at a number of wealth managers in London and also worked at a hedge fund. And my primary focus there was actually on the trading side. And since the start of this year, I've been working on Koya with my two other co-founders, Iris and Ben.
Cool. Very cool. And so, you know, you mentioned your three co-founders. So how did, you know, Koya start, and who came up with the idea? You know, since I think a lot of some co-founders struggle to sell their idea to, you know, potential co-founders, and you know, who brought the other ones into the project, and how did that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's loads of people out there online looking to start businesses, and you know, as Koya was started during the COVID pandemic, we were all still working from home, so there was no way to go out and meet people in person. You know, the usual startup meetups. So Iris and I actually originally met online on a website called Working Startups, and we both came at this from the same perspective, actually. And Ben, our third co-founder, is the same. We've all got a passion for investing, be that crypto, traditional investments, and really personally, we all were very conscious that not enough people invest. We want more people to invest, but we wanted to start a business that wasn't just a normal, let's say, fintech business where, you know, we're doing another brokerage firm or we're doing another financial advisor type thing. We actually wanted to do something totally different. So we decided to approach this from a passion angle. You know, everyone has a passion, and we think actually engaging people's passion, making investing more interesting and engaging for people personally, longer term will not only encourage more people to invest, but enable people to have more fun doing it. So in terms of the idea, well, actually, Iris originally was looking at getting more females to invest generally. And she's really passionate about that. And we met and brainstormed a number of ideas around that aspect. And then taking that, I guess, as one of the seeds, and also my interest in investing and my background, also seeing how family office clients invest in things like passion assets, be that, you know, classic cars or watches, and just realizing that no one has access to this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So Iris and I put our heads together, and sort of the idea of Koya was born. And shortly after, we met Ben, who also has an interest in this space and was looking at investing in whiskey. He's big into crypto as well. And, you know, together as a trio, we settled on Koya, you know, as a concept. And over the past few months, have been bringing that to life.
Cool. And, you know, just a quick question. Weren't you afraid of, you know, meeting someone online, maybe? And, you know, when you meet in person, maybe that, you know, that doesn't work, or there's, you know, some problem around that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always a risk. So, I mean, Iris and I did, and of course, Ben as well, we've all sort of met in person. This hasn't just been fully remote. So fortunately, we're all based in London. So we have, you know, we did meet in person. We've been working together in, you know, in person. But I think times have changed a little bit now. I think people are, just like online dating, people are more open now to meeting people online initially. And some people, you know, work permanently remote. I mean, YC recently has started doing its co-founder sort of matching platform. So I think people are not only more familiar with working remotely, I think, you know, certainly for us, it was important to meet in person. And as a team, of course, now we've been working together for over half a year. So we've really got to know each other well. And yeah, I think that in-person element's been really important. But of course, it's a risk, right? So you've got to be careful who you jump into, you know, this journey with, because it's obviously long and it's challenging.
Right, right. And, you know, moving away a little bit from, you know, co-founder. So you told me the first product you guys will sell on the platform will be a bottle of champagne, and, you know, followed by a watch. You know, yeah. Tell us, how will that be exactly? And yeah, tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've built a mobile app that is somewhat similar to Instagram. You can slide through and find assets you're really interested in, and then dig a little deeper and learn more about them. So we're still pre-launch. We've done one closed asset sale, which was a case of Chateau Mouton Rothschild. So it's a very famous chateau that produces red wine from France. And that went very well with a closed group of beta users, and we were sort of testing the technology. And hopefully in the next few weeks, coming months, we'll be launching our first public sales. And as you mentioned, that'll be a bottle of champagne. So this is a magnum of very exclusive champagne, followed by a Rolex. And, you know, we hope to drop assets one at a time, increasing in frequency over the next sort of several months.
Okay.
So as a user, essentially, you'll be able to invest in these assets. And in around 6 months' time, we're going to be looking to actually introduce a secondary market. So you'll actually then be able to trade these fractions. So you won't just be stuck in them as if you were, you know, buying them outright yourself.
Okay. If at some point a user decides to keep a whole asset, they have to buy, you know, all the shares, like, right?
Yeah, I mean, in principle, you could buy the whole piece. I mean, yeah. That's not really the point, I guess, of the platform. The idea is to enable people who can't afford the whole asset in the first place. And of course, the first three assets are slightly lower value, but longer term, we really hope to only list these iconic assets. So, you know, watches in the hundreds of thousands of pounds, you know, often called grails, and things that are genuinely out of reach, even to maybe people with a lot of money. And I guess another good element from an investor's perspective is that you don't have any of the hassle in terms of storage or insurance. We take care of all of that for you. So it's a really hassle-free way of collecting or investing in these iconic assets that previously are, you know, just totally out of reach.
Right. And so since these are, you know, luxury assets or very delicate and expensive ones, you know, storage and handling are important to keep the value of, you know, that they have. Do you do any of that, or you rely on third parties?
Yeah, absolutely. So we mainly rely on third parties, but we orchestrate all the operations essentially. So let's use wine as an example. So in the UK, Hong Kong, France, another number of other jurisdictions, they have what are called bonded storage facilities. And these are government controlled warehouses essentially. And it's extremely sort of helpful, and they're normally used by people in the wine industry. And you know, the wine is stored in the correct temperature, humidity, lighting conditions. And certainly with fine or investment grade wine, you don't really want to move it around. So often when it's bought and sold between merchants or private collectors, the wine actually often doesn't even move. It will stay in the same warehouse, and the name's essentially updated in the database, or maybe the barcode on the box. So yeah, I mean, that's an example on the wine side of how things are stored. And of course, they're fully insured, and it's much more efficient, not only from our perspective operationally to do that, But it's also, I guess, from an investor perspective and also an operational perspective, just a lot cleaner because, you know, we know things are being done professionally.
Wow. This is very cool. Like, yeah, because I've never heard of it, maybe because I'm not in the, you know, into this industry. Like, I don't know much about it, but this is actually very cool.
Hey, guys, just a quick note here. This is me, Roger, almost half a year later after recording that. And I got to say, that's what I just said. It's completely untrue. The whole thing has changed a lot, you know, on my side. Because I don't know if back then was working for this company I'm working for now. Right now I'm like a little nerd in crypto, also NFTs and, all this world. So I totally know about it now. Let's get back into the episode, but I just wanted to point that out. So, all right, take it easy.
And, since you mentioned before, you worked in the, the investment industry, wealth and investment management, and as well as you've been in, hedge funds as well. You said that kind of influenced you to, get into alternative investments, Sequoia, but how much did that influence you? And would you be here if it wasn't for that?
Yeah, I think from a personal perspective, and one of the reasons I originally went into that financial services industry was that I was just, interested in investing myself generally. So I guess it does naturally dovetail into the formation of Koya with Iris and Ben, and obviously their perspective on investing and their passion for it as well. I think from in terms of sort of getting here, it's impossible to say. I mean, I've always wanted to start my own business, and it provides a level of creativity that you don't necessarily have in a larger corporate structure if you're working, as one of the hundreds of other employees. Of course, it comes with challenges and it's exciting. But I think the investment experience will certainly help us at Koya, as we grow, particularly thinking around things like the secondary market, having obviously a lot of experience dealing with that, let's say within the wealth management context or within the hedge fund context, there's a lot of lessons that can be learned and implemented, as we build out Koya.
Cool. So since you were a kid, you wanted to start something, you wanted to build a company. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things, that loads of people always talk about, and often people don't ever, actually pull the trigger and go and do it. I mean, I had a number of sort of hobby websites prior to this, just as little side hustles, but more playing around other than anything else. But I decided, I wanted to take the leap, and, very fortunate to have found Ben and Iris to work with. They both bring, a lot of experience to the table in the startup space. Iris has always worked in startups and was one of the first employees at Neat, a challenger bank out of Hong Kong. And Ben has got over a decade of development experience at very large banks as well as startups. So, they're both bringing a lot to the table, and it's fantastic to work with them on this project.
And is it easier, starting a company, is it easier or what you expected it would be?
I think it's roughly what I was expecting. Of course, there are challenges that you don't envisage at the outset, and you don't have perfect information on an ongoing basis. You're just trying to make decisions. I think in terms of timing, it's probably never been easier to start a business in many ways. There's so many tools and so many more things are automated. And of course, COVID has forced many people into remote working, which means it's easier to find talent and things like that. On the flip side of that, I guess there's more competition. There's more people than ever trying to do the same thing, trying to raise money. And also from a user perspective, there's more and more products coming out each day. And, the business obviously has to attract that attention. Why would they come to you, not go to someone else? So although it's probably easier than ever to start a business, there are other elements that, of course, get more challenging over time, as well as more and more startups come up.
Right. And, in London, there's a huge, startup hub. And I feel like, it's the startup hub of Europe. So, you're in the right place, I guess. Being three co-founders, I feel like it's easier since, you know, if two of them disagree, then there's a third one that can always, you know, decide what to do. Is it that way, or is it, you know, harder to come up with, decide stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're fairly democratic in the way we make decisions. I think it's useful having three perspectives on problems, just generally to get additional perspectives and input. And I think broadly speaking, you know, when we came together as founders, we all made sure we were aligned in terms of what we wanted to build, but also from a personality perspective. That doesn't mean to say we shouldn't be challenging each other. And you know, I think that's a really important element and actually very useful, have someone to bounce ideas off and have someone to say, actually, I don't think this is the right way of doing it. Let's do it like this. And then you can have a debate and discussion about it. And I think that's really healthy. And I think a lot of the time, if you were, you know, doing this on your own, let's say, it would be harder to make decisions in many ways. Even though, of course, you know, I think with three, it doesn't take longer. I think if you went 4, 5, or 6, you may have a scenario where, you know, things don't get done and decisions can't be made. But I think 2 to 3 is probably the sweet spot.
Right. If you've seen things that haven't worked for other startups before, are you taking those into consideration now to not repeat those mistakes that other people have made? Do you think about that or not at all?
Yeah, I mean, all the time. Of course, you don't want to be looking at others and copying. But I mean, the fractional investing model was somewhat pioneered in the US with a number of companies over there following a rule change with Reg A a number of years ago. And you're now seeing additional elements of that ecosystem. So the Alternative Asset Club newsletter, for example, and various other people who are, you know, engaging audiences based around fractional investing. And that's fantastic to see. But you know, in Europe at the moment, it's very primitive. And, you know, Koya is one of the first businesses trying to tackle these problems and attract this sort of customer in Europe. Of course, there's lots we can learn from startups in the US, but it's that balance of, you know, actually, we're trying to do things a little bit differently. Of course, with the benefit of hindsight, I'm sure we'll make similar mistakes as well. But yeah, I mean, there are valuable lessons. And of course, just generally as well, I mean, you know, one of the biggest challenges for many startups is the cost of acquiring customers. Now, I think we're in a relatively good position in this respect. We're selling something that's really interesting. You know, we're not just selling an ETF. We're selling these iconic assets. They're interesting. People are passionate about them. And I think that can really help us. But we need to leverage that sort of element of the business. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure there'll be many, many challenges down the road, but I think there's a really big market opportunity here. As a team, we're really excited about it. And I think, you know, having seen this take off in the US in a similar way, we're pretty sure there's demand for this type of product.
Yeah. And do you think Europe is more conservative in that sense? Is there going to be more fraction than in the US?
I think Europe as a whole is certainly in certain sort of geographic regions more conservative. And I say probably the consequence for our business is actually the early adopters, certainly maybe a little bit older, a bit of more disposable income, maybe a little bit more savvy around investing. I think in the US, and of course you've got more experience being in the US than I have, but I think the mentality around investing is very different. People normally start to invest earlier. It's something that's actively talked about. And culturally, it's not as common in Europe. Now, I think over the past 2 years, that's started to change quite significantly. And you've certainly seen that, you know, during the pandemic, the number of, increase in brokerage accounts being opened, people investing in crypto. Now, some of this is good behavior and some of it is perhaps more sort of questionable. And of course, lots of regulators are saying this is more akin to gambling than actual investing. But I think certainly from a behavioral change perspective, Europe is catching up relatively quickly with the US. And I think now is actually a really interesting time to be doing this business. And I'm not sure, you know, to be totally honest with you, if it could have worked 5 years ago in Europe, but I think that's changed. And I think for us, that's brought us, you know, quite a strong why now.
Now it's the right time. Cool. Yeah. And you told me you're seeking funding. Do you go straight to your network, the, you know, people you know, or, you know, people you know that might know other people, other VCs, angel investors, or you use, you know, online platforms, which I don't know up to what, you know, degree those work, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a bit of a mix. I mean, we're very fortunate in that Iris and Ben, that Iris and Ben are very well connected. You know, they've been working in the startup scene for a number of years. And Iris also recently completed the Antler program, which is a startup program, and she did that in London. And through that, she also made some very good connections. So our early angel investors were mainly through Iris's personal network, as well as an introduction from a VC fund in London. I think from our perspective, in terms of fundraising, it's a combination of leveraging our own network, but also leveraging other portfolio companies. So speaking to other founders and getting introductions to venture capital firms from them, and then also just being very proactive around networking. We haven't yet used an online tool, let's say, to syndicate deals, but I think the sort of mentality in Europe is probably a little bit different. And a lot of angels would be very keen once you secure a lead VC to invest in the business. So that's certainly something we would consider. And you know, we've spoken to a handful of them so far, but just haven't actually started using the platforms quite yet.
Do you think they can work well, or you're a bit skeptical?
Yeah, I think it depends. Of course, from a founder perspective, there's normally a cost involved, normally a brokerage fee or something similar, which obviously needs to be taken into consideration. But on the flip side of that, it's obviously a lot more efficient reaching 100 or 1,000 people in one go. And I guess importantly, particularly if the deals are being screened before they're being shared to the network, you know, certainly from an angel investor's perspective, there's a lot of value there. You know, there's only so many pitch decks you can read. So it's probably better, and certainly if I was in that position, I would rather read a filtered selection. Of course, maybe you can miss some, but yeah, it depends on the quality of the filter, but I think some of them are very good. I know sort of a handful of people who are running these sort of networks, and yeah, I'd say that on the whole, the quality of investors are very strong, and I like the idea of filtering to a degree.
And what about going into accelerators? Have you thought about that? Is that an option?
Yeah, it's something we've thought about. I think at this stage, we decided against it, primarily because Iris and Ben have a lot of startup experience. Iris, of course, as I said, went through the Antler program, which is somewhat similar to an accelerator. So I think a lot of the learning that we potentially could have got from one of those is hopefully already in the team. Certainly, you know, Bren and Iris can bring that to the table. Of course, you know, there's always, I guess you class something like YC as an accelerator as well. And something like that, clearly from a, you know, perspective of a network that you can build and the brand is very powerful. But I mean, YC is sort of one of a kind, certainly, you know, on the global stage, at least.
And very hard to get in.
That as well.
Yeah. And, you know, we're in the middle of, or hopefully by the end of the COVID crisis. How is starting a company in 2021? Because you guys started this year, right? Is it, you know, harder than would have been before? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's probably easier in some respects. You know, things can be done more remotely, which saves time. You know, just thinking about the investor meetings we've been doing, a lot of it is digital. It's a lot more efficient. At the same time, you know, I do miss that in-person element. And I think, you know, for us, certainly as a team, we've found a nice balance of in-person as well as remote. So yeah, I think it's probably easier in theory than ever. But there are certain elements like making sure you have that human touch. And certainly I'd imagine as you scale a business and start hiring, you need to be very cognizant of that in terms of, you know, are you going to do offsites and meet in person sort of several times a year if you've got a team that's spread out, and trying to forge that company culture. I think is perhaps a little more challenging. And I a number of companies, and Hopin is a great one who's, you know, the founder has spoken about this a little bit in terms of building that remote first culture. And I think as long as you're thinking about it carefully, it's possible. But I think it's, you know, at the same time, if you don't think about it proactively, then it can be certainly more challenging.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, Slack brings us together.
Definitely, yeah.
Makes it easier. And what about the market? Since, you know, you're relying on people to invest in the goods sold on your platform, do you think people are willing to, you know, use their money, your savings to do that?
Yeah, definitely. I think the, as I mentioned, the early adopters in our platform are actually probably already relatively familiar with investing. They've invested before, and they likely hold investments in various places, be that single line stocks, ETFs, funds. And perhaps they've even dabbled in direct investing in wine or whiskey, for example, before. And I think that early adopter is looking for a number of things. One, they're looking for return, but they're also looking for diversification. And looking to invest in things they're actually interested in, right? You can chat about it down the pub or with your friends and engage around the asset class and really sort of dig deeper and educate themselves further. And we've certainly found that a lot of these early adopters are people who are passionate about, you know, let's say watches. You know, they understand it. They've not only seen the, let's say, the appreciation over the past few years and the prices, and in some cases been priced out of being able to participate. So yeah, I'm certainly from a market size perspective, I think the US is evidence this to a degree, but there's a large market, not only from an investment perspective, but also from a perspective of, you know, instead of spending on luxury items directly, you could hold them via our platform. Cool. So
yeah. I mean, yeah. I feel like it's always all about the early adopters, you know, because you cannot go to everyone at first. You know, alternative investments, I don't know, because I don't know much about it, but I feel like it's a pretty new concept. No, is it?
I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
Yes and no. So, I mean, you've had alternative investments for a very long time, and it's something that professional investors, or what you'd often call institutional investors, have had in their portfolios for a very long time indeed. Alternative investments actually captures everything that's not, let's say, traditional. So it could be real estate, it could be hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, and it's all, they're all terms for alternative assets. I think these passion assets that we're starting with, or collectibles, again, have been around for a long time, and some of them come in and out of fashion. You know, antique furniture and coins, or stamps and things like that, you know, have certainly varied in popularity over time. I think, you know, the market there has been around for a very long time. However, only now is it possible to actually get access as an ordinary everyday person without needing, you know, a lot of capital and a lot of expert knowledge quite often to buy these things. You know, and that's one thing that we can help with, is, you know, providing these assets sourced on the platform without the user having to, say, go to an auction themselves or research 20 different wine investment businesses to figure out, you know, who's legitimate, who's not. I mean, for anyone looking at wine investment, for example, there's an amazing documentary out there called Sour Grapes, which I think may still be on Netflix. And it's about a gigantic wine fraud, right? So these markets have nuances that you have to be careful of. And Koya can provide, I guess, that level of trust that you wouldn't necessarily have if you don't have the expert knowledge in-house yourself, you know, if you want to buy these things directly.
Wow. You know, I look at it as what crowdfunding was a few years ago when it got democratized. You guys are kind of doing the same.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is a new market. You know, if you're in Europe, US, there are a number of companies doing this already. But in Europe, it's a fairly new thing. And, you know, there's an education piece here. But I think it's really exciting. And as I said, you know, we are going to be data driven, although we're starting with wine, watches and whiskey. You know, there's no reason why we can't start fractionalizing NFTs or music royalties, and, you know, other income generating assets that people are interested in.
Cool. And so, yeah, so that would be the long-term vision for Koya, right? Like, go to anything that can be.
I mean, we'd love to be the go-to fractionalization platform, let's say, not only for, I guess, the issuance of these items, but also then the trading of them. I mean, one thing that's certainly we're thinking about longer term is the fusion of the real world and the metaverse. So, you know, let's say we were having this conversation in avatars, which is probably not that far off potentially. You know, we could be in a scenario where you could be wearing your fractional, you know, Rolex watch on your wrist that you're an owner, right? Exactly. And, you know, how cool would that be? You know, it's that social capital element. You're seeing people already putting NFTs on their Twitter accounts, and there's an element of exclusivity and, you know, I guess almost boasting around some of these things. But, you know, as we move more into the metaverse and the digital realm, having the ability to, let's say, have a digital replica of something you actually own, it's verified, I think that could be really powerful. And that's something we could do with this fractional ownership model and make it accessible to everyone as well.
Cool. Wow. You just convinced me to use Koya now. Yeah. So, well, I always end with this question, and you know, I think it's pretty cool. So, what's your plan to, you know, have a good impact? You know, conquer the world.
Yeah, I think from our perspective, and I guess it's as I mentioned at the start, it's one of the reasons we all came together. We're passionate about getting more people to invest. And educating people about investing generally. And if we can get people who would never consider investing in traditional things because they just totally don't understand it or they find it too overwhelming or complicated, if we can, I guess, plant that seed and, you know, get them to put aside a little bit of money each month in something they're interested in, and then longer term, that opens up, you know, not only better saving and investment behaviors for a lifetime, I think that would be something that's really powerful. And I think all of us as founders would be, you know, really happy to have achieved that.
Very cool. Well, so if you don't have anything else to add, it was great having you here on the podcast. Thank you for joining us. And yeah, I enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. So yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.